It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. In Northwest Wisconsin, Rice Lake uses a state grant to revamp its Main Street. We examine next steps for downtown revitalization and hear from you. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Justin Fanfara is mayor of the city of Rice Lake. Justin, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning, Kate. How are you?
I'm doing well. Well, turning to your downtown with a new look, reopening after construction for nearly 6 months, what significant changes have been made?
Well, it's been fantastic, actually, the entire project, and so many individuals have been part of it for quite some time, actually. It actually has come all the way through two terms of mayors. When they first had the idea back in 2021 and they started looking toward grant funding, certainly underneath the street, a lot of our pipes needed to be redone. And so that's when they started taking a look at some grant funding. From there, of course, I picked things up. They hadn't finalized things, but they did actually receive the grant. There was a presentation from Governor Evers back in 2022, just before I was seated as mayor. I did happen to attend at that time. And then the council needed to finalize the receiving of the grant, and that actually happened during my term. This project actually had not been redone since 1971, so
wow.
It's truly a 50-year project. Yeah.
So, you know, what do people notice the most? Because stormwater and sewer upgrades can seem a bit invisible.
That is absolutely right. So, maybe the general public certainly needs to understand that when we do things underneath and we have to tear up what's up above, certainly that's the time to beautify particular areas if possible. And so things that are most notable are the brand new street poles and lamp heads, and certainly the currently now Christmas decorations, which are absolutely fantastic. We were able to utilize some of what we had before, but also did purchase a few other things. We had back in 1971, actually, they did have a boulevard in the middle of the what became four lanes. And when it was only two lanes, so now we've brought it back to two lanes and put the boulevards back.
What comes around? Yeah, okay.
Right.
Why
right.
Put the boulevards back?
Certainly for pedestrian safety was one of the main key points of doing that. We have several of our housing developments through our housing authority within that area. Our senior center is placed in the middle of downtown. And so many individuals utilizing just the senior center alone, you know, it's one of the things. It was very difficult for those individuals to get across a four-lane street.
Sure.
To be able to get to where they needed to be. The other thing is we do have a private school that is religious-based, the Catholic school, and they do not house a very large library within their school. So they take advantage of just 2.5 blocks down of getting the kids to our public library. And so certainly as they have a gaggle of children, you know, running across the street, that boulevard certainly offers more safety for them.
We're talking about Main Street revitalization in the city of Rice Lake with Mayor Justin Fanfara. You can join in with your questions and comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Justin, I understand the streetscape concept draws inspiration from Rice Lake being historically named after wild rice. How is this display portrayed?
That's a really good question. we have a little bit of our grass actually that was native here. It's certainly not quack grass. That stuff's for the birds. however, hopefully none pops up next year. I highly doubt it. I don't think they planted anything. Anyway, we do have a little bit of native grass that is there. But right toward the end of the Main Street, right along the lake shore, though, There are several statues that have been created by artisans to be able to note the manumen, as they call it, the food that grows from water. And so it really, as we're continuing to revitalize downtown, we're tipping our hat to all that was before us. And the private group that actually did all of or took care of those sculptures, Dr. Rod Olson, who is now passed, was phenomenal and instrumental in gathering people to have such a great forward thought and be as considerate as possible to years gone by to actually help create those sculptures.
Let's bring on a call now, Olivia in Rice Lake. Olivia, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
I just wanted to note, as far as the Rice Lake Main Street construction goes, that I think a lot of people were actually quite upset about what happened this summer, and there was quite a lot of business that was lost from a lot of the Main Street businesses. Some businesses that were unaware of how long it was going to last for and still kind of waiting on those stoplights and having to hold a community meeting just to get the roads back opened again. So I just wanted to point that out, that I think that it was really a tough summer for a lot of our small businesses in the area.
Olivia, thank you for that. Justin, what was going on with the construction and how downtown businesses were operating in these times?
Absolutely. So as several years had gone by and our downtown area that was affected by this construction project, there, even though there was some retail, there wasn't the booming retail that there used to be once upon a time. Not just retail, but certainly there's some service, a few attorneys, a couple of salons. We currently did not have any food going on except for right at the very end. One of the businesses was there. And it wasn't an ideal time to do it, but they broke ground about May, and contractually this was supposed to be completed by December 1st. And because of a lot of pushback from a lot of the landowners and the businesses there, that's why we ended up having the community meeting that Olivia is actually talking about. And that community meeting was to try and reopen the street because of traffic signal delays directly from the company that actually makes them. We currently are still waiting, and it's certainly well past December 1st to get our street lights back in. Certainly, she says that, you know, there was a lot of business lost. That is absolutely true. We did the best that we possibly could as far as getting their back doors open, those that actually had back doors through our alleyways. Prior to the project, we had all of our alleyways redone. They were all mill and paved at a minimum. Some of them needed a little bit more. So that was addressed prior to the Main Street project to try and make it as accessible for potential customers. And I thought we did the best that we possibly could.
How do you get drivers off of the highway, off of Highway 53, to come and check out your new Main Street?
Right off of Highway 53, which is the main drag, all the way up to, you know, if you're headed north, all the way up to Superior, of course, and it heads all the way down to the south to I-94. And you would actually, on Highway 53, take one of the two exits. Knapp Street is a connecting street to Main Street, as well as Highway County O. So that actually is both of our exits, exit 143 and 140.
Rice Lake Mayor Justin Fanfara with insights on how a recent overhaul of its downtown Main Street could affect the broader community and attract visitors. Be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Add comments. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. As the city of Rice Lake reopens its Main Street after being closed for construction since spring, we connect with Mayor Justin Fonfara on takeaways from the project and efforts to attract people to downtowns. Call in with a question, share your perspective on downtown redevelopment, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Justin, the city's Main Street project received more than $3 million through the Neighborhood Investment Fund, and then the city in turn contributed over $4 million. How did the city budget secure enough funds for this project?
So we, after the neighborhood investment grant was a reality, we were up for a general borrowing at that point, which had already been borrowed for. And then there was a special borrowing yet again for the neighborhood investment grant match, as well as several other projects that were happening in the city. So that's how we procured that.
And going forward, do you find that Rice Lake has the dollars to maintain these upgrades over decades? I mean, you look at this is, you know, a half century in coming.
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. We have had a city administrator for quite some time, Mr. Kurt Snyder, and he has done a wonderful job, actually, in heading us all in a good financial background. Of course, certainly he has helped a lot of the councilmen as well as mayors understand our position. Without that administrator or city manager, of course, some of those individuals that may be elected, thank goodness they're putting their hands in the air, but sometimes we're not all math majors, so to speak, or finance majors. and so it does take an individual to help them understand what they're saying yes and no to.
The city created a new parking enforcement position to oversee the downtown. Why did you take this move?
I'd ask one more time, I'm sorry.
The city creating a new parking enforcement position to oversee the downtown. Can you talk a little bit about parking enforcement and that move?
Oh, is it potential? You're asking about the CSO program.
Got yes.
It. Uh-huh. So the CSO is an individual who is a non-sworn position and will be working with the police department. I'll take it back just a second that as all of us across the entire nation actually struggle for individuals coming into law enforcement, the CSO program actually is a way to help individuals get a taste of what it is to be in law enforcement by not being sworn to begin with, especially those that are educating themselves in the way of law enforcement. And so perhaps this is a good stepping stone right into a position if it is available within the department. The CSO is a community service community service officer. There we go. Sorry about that.
Okay.
And we have created that to help the department actually with parking enforcement. Many of the businesses and residents had said, oh, there's no parking downtown. Oh, there's no parking downtown. I can't get to my stores. I can't park next to it. I can't even park a half a block away. Our 24-hour lots are full. And certainly with a two-hour parking limit all the way on Main Street, there is a four-hour parking limit on all of the side streets that if, of course, business owners are parking in front of their stores all day and these things are not enforced to move them along within 2 hours or perhaps someone else that may live above one of the businesses that does this. Certainly, we've had our fair share of things like that here in the last year. That certainly contributes to some of the issues of there not being enough parking. So that's why we actually looked at this CSO program, so that sworn officers can be busy doing other things that are certainly well needed.
When you talk about people living above stores, above storefronts, we talked with Governor Tony Evers recently to discuss housing insecurity, and Evers mentioned the Main Street Loan Program offered by the Wisconsin Housing and Economic Development and how it's creating affordable housing opportunities.
There's all sorts of apartments that exist that are empty in downtown, small towns especially, and upstairs above different retail outlets that could be used for affordable housing.
Mayor Funfara, do you support using empty spaces in downtown buildings for affordable housing?
Absolutely. And to my knowledge, there are very few that are empty.
Very few.
In our downtown in particular, yeah.
And do you find that, you know, some downtowns having very old buildings, is it financially realistic for developers to upgrade and adapt them into apartments and residences and bring them into compliance for dwelling?
Well, I think with the market as it is, perhaps some of the developers are struggling. This is where we actually look toward our TIDs. And utilizing that as a financial tool to help feasibility gaps. So that's certainly a thing. You know, currently we do have a building that the city does own that was an old nursing home. And it actually was a hospital prior to that, that a company called Moving Out, Madison Base, actually. We've been working with them since 2019 to develop it into apartments that will end up having 45 units out of that. So, yeah.
What is the timeline for that to open?
Well, through COVID and all of the things of 2020, since they did begin the project in 19, they were supposed to have it done, I believe, in 23. However, we have had to extend it, and it should be sometime in summer of 26.
We're talking about Main Street revitalization in the city of Rice Lake. We have Mayor Justin Funfara. You can join in. Questions and comments are welcome at 800-642-1234. Justin, it sounds like Main Street is certainly a bustling place, but does your city grapple with any empty storefronts?
We certainly do. There are a couple, certainly some of those that were leased spaces. Individuals, if their businesses certainly were questionable as far as sales, things like that, they did actually leave the downtown prior to the project. But unfortunately, that had to happen, that they did leave. However, I think coming on the other side of it is that it gives opportunity and way for something new as well. You know, we do have a building that is questionable smack dab in the middle of town that we've been dealing with for quite some time, and it certainly is, from what we understand, needs a lot of help. And we certainly have been trying to work with the landowner, but to no avail, we're not getting very far. But it will remain empty until possibly a developer comes forward and decides to put some money into it.
What do you think, what could Wisconsin downtown districts learn from Rice Lake's revitalization project?
Certainly, after talking with Mayor Jim Payne up in Superior that
sure.
had gone through his Tower Avenue probably about, what, I would say about 8 years ago, I want to say, maybe 6 years ago, something like that, he actually offered me a few words, and he said, you know, rebuilding a downtown is not going to be an overnight thing. It's not just about your project, but it's getting people to believe in the downtown area again. It's not just a shopping mega center. These are small businesses that need to come and realize the value of downtown, and they need to believe in that again. He said, so it may be a 5 to 10 year turnaround. Those are scary numbers, but he said, really, naturally, this will happen. But you'll have great businesses because they believe in the community in Rice Lake, that they will stay and they'll do great things.
In our last 30 seconds or so, it's that, you know, time of year when we take stock and we look to the future. I'm wondering what is high up on your priorities to address next year?
Well, for next year, and I will certainly open it. I'll open this up. I haven't told so many, but now is a great time. I will not be running. And so for now, personal business has actually forced that a little bit with the downturn of the economy back in May. And so I just need to focus on that personally, but certainly will continue to pop my head in, and I may run for the following year.
Well, Justin, thank you so much for joining us. We appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much, Kate. This has been a pleasure.
Justin Fanfara is mayor of the city of Rice Lake, not running for re-election. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. As the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison hires additional cheese tasters, we learn about the art of tasting cheese and developing the vocabulary to describe it. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Brandon Prohaska is sensory coordinator at the center housed within UW-Madison's College of Agricultural and Life Sciences. Brandon, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, Kate. It's a pleasure to be here.
You train cheese tasters at the center. What makes someone qualified to taste cheese for scientific research?
One of the biggest qualifications I look for is just kind of a passion and a genuine interest in cheese and tasting and flavor. There's a little bit of kind of genetics and natural ability that go with it, but so much of the skills that we train are that very trainable, and they come with practice and kind of dedication. So I'm mostly looking kind of for availability and attitude and passion for an interest in the job.
Passion and interest, I think maybe quite a few of us could land in that box. But how is tasting cheese for research different from how people eat cheese for meals?
Yeah. When we're eating meals, usually we're looking for things like what tastes the best, what's enjoyable, eating with family and that kind of experience. But tasting for research is a lot more methodical. Some of my panelists have told me they don't really think of it as pizzas or cheese or food. They think of it just kind of this is the work we're doing and treating it a little bit separately. And it's just that very methodical. Everything is kind of prescribed down to what temperature do we taste at? How many chews do we do? How forcefully do we chew? And a lot of other things that kind of just standardize how we taste it. So we're almost becoming like machines when we're evaluating this cheese.
Wow. Can you walk us through some of those specific stages that a cheese tester goes through to evaluate each, cheese specimen, if you will?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. When we first start training people, we kind of break it down into categories. So we might talk about texture, we might talk about appearance, flavor, and then other things like functionality, like when we look at pizzas, how it stretches, how it flows, how much oil is released. So we kind of break it up into subcategories. And then with each of those subcategories, we have specific attributes. And we kind of define what does that attribute mean? What is it? What isn't it? And then also how we approach evaluating it. So we might say, okay, for this attribute, we're going to do 7 chews. We're going to use our molars. And then we're going to evaluate by moving our tongue back and forth in our mouth and seeing how that cheese broke down. Like that's kind of just a snapshot of what one specific attribute might look like.
Do tasters swallow the cheese?
That's always something people ask. Kind of our protocol is we actually spit out the cheese. You know, we're going for 3 hour sessions and we're tasting, you know, maybe 30 to 40 samples in a given day. So if we were to swallow them all, we would be kind of toast by the end of the day. But usually what I tell people is if, you know, through the course of those 40 samples, if you find one you really like and you're getting a little bit hungry, feel free and swallow that, because we can kind of sift through and find the most delicious sample and enjoy that. We don't have to worry about eating every single thing.
So how do the cheese tasters cleanse their palate between each bite?
Yeah, kind of the bare minimum we have for everyone is in our software. We kind of have a built-in kind of 30-second just time cleanse in between where, you know, we're letting the previous sample dissipate. Sometimes there's like a lingering aftertaste that just hangs around. So time is our best weapon. And then we also have water. And sometimes if it's a pretty intense lingering taste, we have things like crackers that people will go to. But for the most part, just time and water is what the majority of people will use to cleanse their palate in between.
So should you bring your cheese to room temperature before sampling it?
You know, there's a lot of different ways you can look at it. The protocol we have here at CDR is when we're evaluating cheese, just kind of at, you know, room temperature or refrigerated temperature, we actually have a cold incubator that brings it to 11 degrees Celsius, which is somewhere kind of between a little bit warmer than your normal refrigerator. There's no really right or wrong way to do it. We just say this is our convention. This is the number we've used. And, you know, we've been doing research here for over 20 years, and that's kind of just what we've stuck with.
So consistency is really important as you sample one cheese to the next. You really want to make sure all your variables are in order.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And even cheese, you know, is kind of a living product, and it can change over time as it ages. So we also have kind of a 48-hour window where we have to evaluate that cheese before, you know, it might soften up or the flavor might change a little bit. So even if we control everything temperature-wise, the age is kind of another variable that we're working against.
So I wonder, do you start tasting with the mildest cheese or the strongest cheese? Like where does the blue cheese go? Is it early or late?
Yeah. So, I mean, when we talk to people in the industry who are grading cheeses and they might be looking at a wide variety, yeah, we definitely advocate for as much as possible to go from kind of mild to intense. But when we're talking about more formal sensory methods, generally we have a approach where we randomize and balance the distribution, where if we have 8 samples and 8 panelists, they're all going to start with a different sample first. In general, our descriptive panel is going to taste the same category of cheese in a given session. So, you know, if we're tasting cheese, we're either tasting cheddar or mozzarella or blue. So, you know, they're all going to be similar in that way, but there may be one sample that has a really strong off flavor, but we really won't know that till we evaluate. So someone might get that first and someone might get that last, but that's just kind of how we do sensory to make sure that everything is balanced so that we're not introducing a variable by the order that they're presented.
Brandon Prochaska is sensory coordinator at UW-Madison Center for Dairy Research. As we talk about the work of cheese testers, you can join in with your questions and comments along the way, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Brandon, your center uses reports collected from its cheese tasters for specific research. What scientific questions are these tasters helping to answer?
Yeah, and it's a good balance between both kind of academic research as well as things that our clients in the industry are interested in. So we may get samples from clients who are maybe trialing a new culture, or they're bringing a new plant online and they're looking for answers of, you know, is this cheese we're making today the same as it was before? So it's hard to get that just from instrumentation. So the human element is always going to be key. So that sometimes our reports are just answering questions we get from industry clients. But on the academic side, those are typically applied research as well, where it's kind of big overarching questions that the industry as a whole has. So some things we're looking into there would be things like, concentrated milk is becoming more common to use in cheese making, and the product is somewhat a little bit different sometimes in functionality and flavor. So we're trying to find ways to kind of make that more consistent with kind of traditional cheese making methods. We might also be looking at kind of more innovation type ideas of how can we produce, say, a shelf-stable cheese snack that has cheese as the primary ingredient and make it look good and taste good and last and be safe on the shelf. And then the other thing that is probably near and dear to a lot of people's hearts is we're actually doing some research into how to prolong the squeakiness of cheese curds, where they're just about as squeaky as they were the day they were made, even though they might have been on the shelf for maybe a week or so.
In terms of the use of concentrated milk, is that manufacturers who are just trying to trim costs in production?
I mean, cost is always a factor when it comes to manufacturing, but I would say the primary thing they're looking at there is yield and kind of like eliminating waste. So when you're cheese making, you might have, you know, solids going off in the way that might not otherwise be captured in the cheese. So they're looking for a way to utilize everything that's coming in that fluid milk right away and kind of have less waste and loss that way. So it does help reduce the cost that way, but also as kind of a way around sustainability and efficiency where, you know, also utilizing the maximum the equipment can bring without using additional energy.
And I would imagine, too, the milk has to be consistent from one batch to the next. You're looking for very consistent raw materials that you put into the product.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Cheese making is extremely complex, as I've come to learn working here, you know, manufacturing being one of the big steps that will affect the quality of the cheese. So, yeah, both the quality of the milk and how it's manufactured is going to have a big impact, but then also kind of how it's aged will have another big impact on how that cheese will come out in the end. So, yeah, the raw materials are extremely important for the quality of the cheese.
How do your cheese testers measure the texture of cheese?
Mm-hmm. So yeah, we have a lot of different kind of subcategories within cheese. Some of the main kind of attributes we look at would be things like firmness in the hand and first chew hardness. So one thing that people always get a kick out of is when we're doing hand firmness, we actually have these different things called therapy putty, where there are various firmnesses. They're typically used in like kind of rehab, physical rehab, where people are working their way up from a very soft putty to a very firm putty. And we actually use those to kind of compare against to rate the firmness of the cheese. And then we have a lot of different attributes that go on kind of as chewing and breakdown. So we have things like cohesiveness and adhesiveness. So like how much does it stick to itself? How much does it stick to your teeth? The particle size, is it kind of grainy or gritty as it breaks down, or is it nice and smooth? And then just kind of the overall chewiness, like is it tough to chew or is it nice and kind of soft and easy to swallow?
I also saw the pictures of you using a ruler to measure how far a cheese stretches. Why is stretch important?
Yeah, so we kind of talk about how cheese changes with time and kind of with pizza and melting applications. Mozzarella kind of exhibits that where when the cheese is very young, it's very tough and kind of hard to pull. So you kind of feel it as you're stretching it with the fork and it may not stretch very far on that ruler. And then kind of it gets to the sweet spot where it becomes kind of more softer, more pliable, much more stretchy. And then when it gets really old, it kind of gets soupy and soft and you can barely get it to stretch. It kind of breaks right as you try to pull it. So it just kind of helps us approximate and see the integrity and the performance of that cheese. Is it going to act the way people would expect it to when they buy a pizza from, you know, their favorite pizzeria, or is it kind of not quite in that sweet spot anymore?
Brandon Prohaska is sensory coordinator at the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. As we discuss the scientific cheese tasting process, call in with a question. You can share your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We hone our cheese tasting abilities as the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison hires cheese taste testers Brandon Prohaska is sensory coordinator at the center, and you can be part of this conversation about cheese. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Jeff in Delafield is here. Hi, Jeff.
Yes, good morning. Great topic. My question is seasonality, and do you see changes in flavors of a specific cheese based on seasonality and what the cows might be eating from one season to the next? And do you see a difference with, you know, cows that might be, you know, pasture fed, you know, rotational grazing from pasture to pasture versus, you know, more industrial type of producer that just feeds, you know, stored up forage?
Jeff,
thank you.
Yeah, Jeff, thank you. Brandon.
Actually, yeah, great question. Yeah, in general, the feed of the cows has a great big impact on the flavor of the milk as well as the flavor of the cheese. You know, we kind of illustrate in short courses differences you might see, like grassy notes, things like that, that might make their way into the cheese based on how the cows were grazed. And we kind of see organic cheeses or cheeses from, you know, Ireland or New Zealand having a lot of those grassy notes. Kind of in general with what our descriptive panel tastes, we're almost always kind of blinded to kind of what happens upstream, like how the cheese was made or whatever. So we're getting cheeses kind of blind and just tasting them and like a machine kind of giving the results of what we're tasting. So our cheesemakers, a lot of the cheese we make is made right here at CDR. Our cheesemakers do a great job of kind of eliminating variables about seasonality, but it's always going to be something that we're kind of working against as far as trying to keep a consistent product when we're doing research. But yeah, the seasonality and the grazing has a big impact on the flavor of the cheese for sure.
The Center for Dairy Research, you use terms like sheepy and goaty to describe flavor. What do these terms mean?
Yeah, so we kind of have what we call a lexicon, which is kind of like our dictionary or our glossary of terms. And so much of what we're training the panelists to do is kind of use a shared common language. So the goaty and sheepy are kind of examples of what we would call attributes. And we kind of define what those are. And in those cases with like sheepy and goaty, there are specific compounds present in sheep and goat's milk specifically that give it a unique taste. So we might show those specific chemicals as a reference. We might show them goat or sheep's milk cheese, kind of show them that flavor from a few different angles, and then they kind of learn to recognize that. And then their other job, once they found it, is to quantify how intense that flavor intensity is so that we can kind of quantify how much is there.
So, Brandon, are there specific terms we should know to better communicate with cheesemongers on the other side of the counter when we're shopping?
Yeah, that's a really great point. We actually have quite a few short courses here at CDR where we are teaching cheesemongers some of these same terms. But the biggest issue we see is that they're usually terms that consumers at home would not necessarily be using. So for example, in my day-to-day work, we might call something rancid or butyric, and what people at the cheese counter might use a term like piquant. So actually, I'm looking into possibly doing a kind of a project around making a good translation from what we would use on the technical side and the terms we use here in descriptive analysis and how those translate and relate out to people, you know, in the normal cheese world.
I think there's room for that. There's definitely a place for that. Let's bring in Lauren in Cedarburg. Lauren, hi.
Hi, this is Laura in Cedarburg. I love everything cheese, especially cheesy jokes and puns, but I have a question about cheddar and specifically aged cheddar. As it ages, my understanding is that it gets these crystals, and every time I've had an aged cheddar with these crystals, the mouthfeel is incredible. And I would just like to learn more about how they're formed and how they are, I guess, graded when you're doing a mouthfeel test.
Yeah, great question. So there's a few different ways crystals can develop. I know there's some on the outside of the cheese, and then there's some that form in the interior of the cheese. I'm still learning some of the aspects of cheese technology and chemistry, but most of them are formed either called calcium lactate or from amino acids that break down. So as that cheese ages, the protein breaks down into the individual amino acids, and then those tend to kind of organize and crystallize over time. So like tyrosine crystals are one of the things that you might see. So to your point, yeah, aged cheddars that have those crystals, typically very tasty. People enjoy that. And what we teach at CDR is everything is related to the context. So if you had a mild cheddar or like a sliced cheddar for a hamburger and those crystals were in there, people would typically say that's a defect. I don't like that. There's something wrong with the cheese. But if you've got a nice, you know, several year old cheddar with quite a bit of age on it, and you're tasting it just in small amounts to kind of enjoy it, then the crystals are a good thing. We don't have a scale or anything for particularly for crystals, mostly because a lot of the research we're doing right now is on mozzarella and we don't see crystals in there. But that's kind of a good point of if we do start evaluating a new product category, we sometimes will have to develop new attributes and scales from the ground up. And that's kind of a really fun process, too.
Brandon Prohaska with us at the Center for Dairy Research at UW-Madison. Let's go to Glenn in Iola. Glenn, hi.
Yes, thanks for taking my call. So my question was very similar to what he was just talking about with the sharp cheddar. I'm a sharp cheddar fan, and I always look for extra sharp. You know, I try different brands, and I never, very seldom do I ever get a really good sharp cheddar that's got extra flavor. And I even buy extra sharp cheddar, and it just doesn't have the oomph that I'm looking for.
Doesn't have the oomph. Yeah. Brandon, go ahead.
Yeah. I guess one thing I would say on the topic is, you know, the terms around medium cheddar, sharp cheddar, extra sharp cheddar, you know, especially kind of just in the normal dairy case, doesn't necessarily mean a whole lot. And that one of those words like sharp, to me, that's one word we avoid on the technical side, because for us, it doesn't mean a whole lot. You're right where, you know, extra sharp typically would be some of the older aged cheese. But my recommendation to people always is if they're looking for a particular flavor or experience with cheese, kind of find a maker or a brand more so than whether it says sharp or extra sharp. You know, we've got a lot of great cheesemakers here in Wisconsin, you know, Hooks or Hennings or something like that are, you know, great people to check out. And just find the maker that you like, go to a place where you can sample the cheese, find what you like, and then kind of stick with that brand. Because typically the smaller and more local the manufacturer is, the more consistent that you can believe that product will be. And just stick with that maker and you won't be disappointed.
So is it better to taste cheese alone or in a group? Does sampling among friends or among cheese tasters influence what you experience in the flavor?
Yeah, that group experience definitely can influence. So, I mean, when we're doing for research, we're always, you know, kind of isolated and quiet and just doing it ourselves. But, you know, if you're doing something like a cheese board or whatever, that's a great way to kind of learn, you know, what other people are tasting. I mean, everyone's going to have their own personal opinion, but I think just the social environment and the enjoyability of being with a group of people enjoying cheese, hard to beat that.
In our last few moments together, you do have volunteers for to taste cheeses as well in the research. When are consumers a better fit for a project rather than using the center's own cheese testers?
Yeah, so we get client work as well where they're looking for, you know, we're developing a new product and want to see how consumers react. Because our panel is so well trained and very technical, they aren't really good consumers anymore. So that time we recruit people from the general public to come in and taste that instead.
Brandon, thank you for joining us.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you so much for having me, Kate.
Brandon Prohaska is sensory coordinator at the Center for Dairy Research in the College of Agricultural and Life Sciences at UW-Madison. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.